This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Twice four teams still retain the hope of winning all the beans. Four squads of women, four of men. And what this finally means is that our guesses, bad as they have been and still might be, cannot be wholly useless. Each can only miss by three. On that optimistic note, I'm joined on the line from St. Louis, site of this year's men's Final Four, by ESPN's Pat Forty, though we prefer to refer to him as Only a Game's Pat Forty. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Today's first game features Louisville and Illinois. Will the very hot Cardinals beat this season's number one team in the polls, that being, of course, Illinois?
You know, I think that they match up very, very well with Illinois, and actually match up in the most important area, which is sheer will to win. These are two teams that hate to lose. But on that note, I think that Illinois' will is a little bit stronger, perhaps. I think that they lost one game on one shot with 5 seconds left by 1 point, and I think that they will be in the final on Monday.
Today's second game pits Michigan State against North Carolina. Is it fair for observers to wonder whether Carolina's Roy Williams will fail yet again in the penultimate quartet?
Sure. I'm wondering that. They have the best talent. They've had it, all year. There's not much excuse other than the fact that it's just hard to win a title. But in terms of which team here on paper is the best team, it's North Carolina. So the pressure is on Roy to finally put a ring on his finger.
To what extent will the personalities and aspirations and histories of Louisville's Rick Pitino, Michigan State's Tom Izzo, Illinois' Bruce Weber, and Carolina's Roy Williams influence the tournament's final outcome?
Well, I think we're going to really have, that's going to be very interesting to see, first of all, just how Bruce Weber has approached this thing, because he's the only one that hadn't been here before. He's the pup, as he put it himself this week. And I know he's put calls out around the country. How do you handle this thing? You know, when do you come in? How much freedom do you give your kids? How much time do you spend, out on the town versus cloistered in the hotel? That sort of thing. So he's really, I think, done his homework. He's a very, very good coach, but he's going up against a Rick Pitino who has, I think established himself as the guy that's right next to Mike Krzyzewski, is the two best coaches in college basketball. He's taken his third team to the Final Four. He's the first coach to ever do that. And Rick's thing at this time of year is play loose, play fearless, have fun. Don't feel the pressure. And we'll see whether Illinois feels the pressure or whether they can find a looseness in this sort of thing. So on that side, it's going to be an interesting matchup. On the other side, you've got two great veteran coaches who have been here before, Tom Izzo, Roy Williams. Izzo's team is playing with house money, in my opinion. They weren't supposed to be here, but they've put together a great run, beat a number one seed in Duke, beat a number two seed in Kentucky in an epic game, and now they're playing the team that everybody thinks is the team to beat, so they should play with a degree of looseness. And then Carolina has, I think, a little more pressure because this is the team that people expect to win, and this is the coach that people keep wanting to see whether he will win.
You have recently written that Rick Pitino, who's been criticized for his brashness and his megalomania and streams of blue language as well, has mellowed with age and now really appreciates his latest of five Final Four opportunities. What do you base that conclusion on?
Well, I've covered him since 1990. I've been around him a lot, and he's just, I've seen him as a more relaxed person. Small anecdotes, when they lost at Houston this year, he's the world's worst loser, which is one of the reasons he doesn't lose very often, Bill. And they lose at Houston to an okay team, an NIT team, but still a big upset, and they blow the game late. And this is the kind of thing where usually, he's going to go Linda Blair, his head's going to be spinning, and, there's going to be just blue streaks up and down the room. He's going to be killing his assistants and killing his players. And according to the players, he went in the locker room and said, go home and tell somebody in your family you love them. Keep your priorities straight. That's what's the most important thing in life. Let's not get too bent out of shape about this loss. And for that to be Rick Pitino, that is just astounding to me. And that shows he lost his brother-in-law and his best friend, Billy Minardi, in the World Trade Center tragedy. And I really think that changed his perspective on life to a large degree.
I like the fact that Michigan State has teams in the men's and in the women's Final Fours. Magic Johnson's mom must be whipping up a nice meal for all of East Lansing, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's a great moment for them. You know, especially on the men's side, we hadn't seen them since the Flintstones came through, and I think some people were wondering, you know, had Tom Izzo kind of lost his verve there, but he's obviously got it back, and to have the women there as well, that campus should be going crazy.
Well, we spoke with Michigan State's Joanne McCauley last week, and she told us that she had asked her players to play loose, kind of the Rick Pitino strategy. Is this going to be something that all the Final Four coaches say?
You know, if I were, I would. I mean, if I were coaching in the Final Four, I just think that the pressure can be so big at this time of year, and you're dealing with, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old people, that the less they're thinking about how big the stakes are, probably the better off they are. And, you know, to play to a degree without thinking, you know, just to go out there and kind of play almost by rote or by muscle memory, and, you know, just try to have fun with it. I think that if I were the coach, that would be the message I would try to impart.
A Michigan State win tomorrow over Tennessee would give Coach McCauley's career a bit of a boost, as would a subsequent win against the winner of LSU-Baylor. But what do you think? Can that happen?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that it's possible. Now, I mean, you hate to bet against Pat Summitt in that sort of situation, and she's done it so many times, but I think it would be great for women's basketball to see some new blood on that podium on you know, with the championship trophy. I just think that, you know, we've seen so much Tennessee and so much Connecticut that it's nice, first of all, to have three other teams there, but then we'll see if one of those can actually take the title away from Tennessee.
Well, the time has come for you to tell us who you think is going to win each of these titles.
All right. I'm going to go with North Carolina. They're a little bit casual. They're a little bit careless. But as Rick Pitino himself says, talent prevails at this time of year, and they have the best talent. And then on the women's side, what the heck, I'm going to go with LSU. Simone Augustus, wonderful player. The SEC, I think, probably plays the best women's basketball, so we'll take them over Rocky Top.
Pat Forde covers college basketball and other matters for ESPN.com, and he joined me on the line from St. Louis. No surprise there, site of the men's Final Four. Thank you, Pat.
My pleasure, Bill. Have a good time.
Last year's Detroit Pistons championship notwithstanding, the common NBA wisdom still says that the winner of the league's Western Conference will also take all the beans in the NBA Finals. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, there's at least one Eastern Conference team that's saying not so fast.
2 years ago, the Miami Heat finished with a miserable 25-57 record that prompted head coach Pat Riley to resign. Riley stayed on as team president and last season watched his successor, Stan Van Gundy, guide the Heat to a 42-40 finish and a trip to the postseason. This year, the Heat have gone 54-19 and have become one of the premier teams in the NBA. Veteran Eddie Jones has played with the Heat for 5 years and has been a party to the transformation.
I mean, we were really young last year, and I don't think you really knew what to expect until we actually got there on the floor and started playing. And we went to the second round of playoffs, so that was great. This year, we came in with higher expectations with, you know, acquiring Shaquille O'Neal.
O'Neal arrived via trade last summer from the Los Angeles Lakers. He's averaged almost 23 points and 10.5 rebounds a game for Miami. But Van Gundy says he's seen much more than big statistics from O'Neal, who earned 3 world championships in L.A.
Well, he just draws so much attention that he opens things up for everybody else. So a lot of times guys are getting open shots or driving the ball to the basket. The ball's never even touched Shaq inside, but the defense has stayed glued to him, and it just makes it easier for everybody else.
O'Neal has been credited with turning around franchises in Orlando and Los Angeles, and says he's ready and willing to assume the same role here.
That's something I accept. I just know how stuff is supposed to be done. And I've been sticking to my formula for a long time, and my formula has been working. On the court, I'm a team player. I make everybody better. I help fill the arena up. I help with the marketing. And it's a good time for the city of Miami now.
Meanwhile, guard Dwayne Wade has followed a successful rookie year with an even better sophomore season. He's averaging 24 points a game and shooting an impressive 48%. Miami coach Van Gundy says that Wade is way ahead of his years.
It's not a matter of whether he's a young guard or anything else. He's just one of the best guards in the league right now. He's a guy capable of doing about anything you could want somebody to do. He can defend, he can rebound, set other people up. people will do things defensively to him and bother him for a while, but then he will make the adjustment. He's very mature, very smart, and he makes good decisions down the stretch in games.
The team's other three starters, Eddie Jones, Damon Jones, and Udonis Haslem, each chip in better than 10 points a game. But it's hard to miss the tandem of O'Neal and Wade, and its on-court resemblance to the 8-year partnership of O'Neal and all-star Kobe Bryant in L.A. While Bryant chafed at sharing the stage and has since led his Lakers to a losing season, Wade says he's thrived under the tutelage of O'Neal.
I'm on the rise of becoming, you know, my own player right now, and he's helping me do it, so I owe a lot of credit to him. He helped me a lot off the court, a lot of different things, and it just translates to on the court because we're both on the same page.
It's no secret that the Heat have feasted this year on a weakened Eastern Conference. To win an NBA championship, they'll have to face the best of the West. O'Neal, who knows that conference better than any of his teammates, likes the Heat's chances.
I think we match up pretty well as long as we play smart. Like, you know, certain teams that have an inside presence, we match up well with them. But the teams that, you know, shoot the ball very well, they're going to have to shoot the lights out of the ball to beat us.
The Heat have just 9 games remaining in the regular season, including tonight's contest in New Orleans against the Hornets. They'll be fighting for home court advantage throughout the NBA playoffs, which begin later this month. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Miami.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Auto racing veteran Bernie Ecclestone spent much of last week reaching an out-of-court settlement with 3 banks regarding the control of his sport. Then, over the weekend, the king of the business of Formula One auto racing lost his ride. The British billionaire's new silver Mercedes was parked outside his London home when thieves jacked it up and stole 2 of the wheels. The car, a CLS 55 AMG V8, was the first of its kind in Great Britain. They probably think they can sell the wheels and make some money, Ecclestone said, but they probably can't. It's a real nuisance, he added. It was only the first night I had the car. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Pizza and panini in the dugout, baseball Italian style. But first, tomorrow night, sans the distractions that lesser confrontations might have posed, the Yankees will host the Red Sox and Major League Baseball will begin. The following day, assuming the game in New York doesn't render anything any of the 28 other teams might have done over the next 6 months completely inconsequential, various other ball clubs will begin to play. Joining me now to talk about Armageddon tomorrow night and the rest of the season as well, if there's any time left, is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Whatever happened to the quaint notion that the Cincinnati Reds should play in each season's first game and that it should occur in sunlight?
Well, that's a good question, Bill. At least we're opening the season in this country. At least we're opening in prime time. Dopes like me woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning this time last year to watch the Yankees play in Japan, and that was a bit much. So I think this is a much better alternative, but I'm with you. I think the first game of the season should be an afternoon game at one of the cities that's had baseball for 150 years. But TV runs the show, as always, and TV wanted Sunday night, and that's what we're getting.
As this season begins, the great question seems to be what baseball without steroids will look like. It may not be entirely fair, this question, but it's there. Will we see a monstrous increase in fly balls that only make the warning track?
You know, I don't think so, Bill. I think players are smaller this spring. I think they've been getting smaller for 2 years, and it's not my imagination. The interesting thing is the numbers, the offensive numbers, have not gone down basically across the board. There are still a ton of runs and a ton of home runs hit. in the last 2 years, even with players getting smaller, and I fully expect that to happen again this year, partly because not all the people who came off of steroids are everyday players. Some of them are pitchers. But the bottom line is this. The ball is as hard as a rock. We play in tiny little ballparks with a tiny little strike zone, and the hitters today, even naturally, are bigger than they've ever been. They're really strong, and they're really good. So I think we're going to see a tremendous number of runs scored this year, just like in the last 10 years.
Some of your ESPN colleagues have made the claim that we are currently in the, quote, post-steroids era. But considering the availability of undetectable performance-enhancing substances, can that claim really be made?
You know, it can't be, Bill. In fact, it can't even come close to making that claim. We had a big summit meeting with ESPN recently, and we got to meet some doctors and some people that really know about steroids. And we all came out of this thinking that there are more loopholes in this program than anything, and it is so easy to dodge a test. It is so easy to take one test and not take another one the rest of the year. And my concern is that guys are smart enough to get around this stuff, and some guys are going to stay on it and not get caught. Now, I still think a bunch of people are off of it. I still think the plan is working to some degree. But is it going to work perfectly if there are no positive tests this year? I'm not that naive. I think guys have a way to get around this, and that is unfortunate.
Barry Bonds, who would certainly have been in the spotlight if he were healthy enough to play tomorrow, has said that he may be out for half the season or even longer. What's your best guess at this point about when he'll be back?
Well, first off, I'm not buying what Barry Bonds said for this reason. Nobody, but nobody loves to play more than that guy does. And I think he's going to be back in the middle of May. I am guessing on this, Bill. We're all guessing on this. But if you listen to that initial press conference he had this spring, when he wasn't screaming at the media, he was telling everybody how much he loved to play the game. And I think it was a setback with the knee, but I think he'll be back in the middle of May. And I think when he comes back, he'll be great because he's always great.
There's been a lot of discussion about how fans should feel about Bonds' pursuit of Henry Aaron's home run record. Do you have any ambivalent feelings about it?
No, I actually have strong feelings on this, and I think Barry Bonds should be allowed to continue to break these records, and then we will find out more and more as we go along, and then it will be time to make our final decision on exactly what he has done and how it affects his performance and how it should affect the record books. At this point, we just don't have nearly enough information to start taking anybody's records away or keeping anybody out of the Hall of Fame or insisting that guys retire. We just don't know. Bill, I am married to a lawyer. I am the son of a mathematician. We do not have enough proof. We do not accuse without proof. And at this point, Barry Bonds is innocent as far as I'm concerned. But we need to see where this goes from here, and I need proof before I'm going to do anything drastic.
Tim, Barry Bonds isn't the only headliner who will miss the beginning of the season. Curt Schilling of the Red Sox will not pitch on opening day. The Yankees' starting pitching is certainly not entirely sound, and that's also true of the Cubs. The list goes on and on. I thought the offseason was supposed to be when everybody rested and got healthy.
Well, and that used to be, Bill, but now guys, I believe, work out so hard, their bodies are so firm, and they're so tight that they end up pulling something and getting hurt. And in the case of, say, Mark Pryor, I think it's a case where guys say, look, I am a huge investment here, and I am not going to go out there and pitch if I'm injured. And the Chicago Cubs back him up on that. In fact, they're more cautious than he is. And that's the problem with today's baseball, to me at least. We have bigger, stronger, faster, better players, period. And yet they get hurt way, way more than anybody, you know, in the 40s, the 50s. It's absolutely ridiculous when you look at the disabled list today. I've said this many times. We have three leagues today, the AL, the NL, and the DL.
All right, we've come to the part of this conversation where I ask you to make some predictions, Tim, and I don't want you to be influenced by the fact that the only possible way this season can match last season for drama is for the Chicago Cubs to win the World Series.
All right, that's a very good point, Bill. I root for the story, and the Cubs are the best story of the year, and I'm here to tell you I don't think it's going to happen this time around. Here are my fearless predictions. Please put the tape recorder on, because I want you to play these back in October to see how many I got wrong.
Don't doubt that it will happen.
All right, I've got the Yankees, the Twins, and the Angels winning the division in the American League, with the Red Sox winning the wild card. In the National League, I've got the Braves, Cardinals, and Giants winning the division, with the Marlins as the wild card. And in my World Series, I have the Yankees beating the Braves. And if anyone really takes this to the bank, they are making a big mistake.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and for ESPN the magazine, and he lends his expertise, such as it is, and qualified as it is, to only a game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
3 years ago, Canadian Dave Bedini decided the best way to become acquainted with Italy, his ancestral home, was to travel with an Italian baseball team. His recently published account of a season with the Nettuno Piones is entitled Baseballissimo, My Summer in the Italian Minor Leagues. Dave Bedini joins me now from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Manitoba. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
It's an honor, Bill.
Well, thank you. The Piones, the team with which you spent the summer, took their name not from a fierce animal, a tiger or an eagle, say, but from landless Mexican peasants. Whose idea was that?
Go figure. I think it was, their logo was actually etched out on a napkin of one of the local trattorias, I was told that. But Piones, geez, I don't even know if they ever got to the bottom of that. But fitting, actually, because they were you know, neither fearsome nor mighty in many ways. They were Piones in their own regard. But that only, I mean, they had a very sort of freewheeling attitude about playing the game. A great, very carefree in many ways, and that was part of their charm, actually. I mean, I often find when you're writing about sports, it's tough to kind of penetrate the, you know, jocks. People who play at a higher level have to be serious to a point. They really have to bear down. But because it was B-level ball, and because they were playing on these glorious Italian afternoons, you know, and the dugout was filled with food, they didn't dig in as you'd expect, you know, players in, you know, major league ball players to dig in.
At the beginning of your stay in Italy, the manager of the Piones, Pietro, told his players that they had to play well this season because a writer had arrived to tell their story. How did you feel about being used as a motivational tool?
Well, I was happy. I mean, because I think Pietro needed a little bit of this to get these guys off their ass, you know, and to, you know, every at-bat for them was significant when I was watching. I mean, and I think, but they didn't really understand what, I think they actually thought that I might, that I'd sort of flunked out of Boswell College, that, you know, this poor writer wasn't good enough to write about Major League Baseball. He had to come to Italy. So I was lacking in credibility in a lot of ways. And certainly when they saw me take a few swings, they wondered really what on earth what right I had to be playing with them anyways. But, I found whenever I've done this sort of world sports travel, because I've done it with hockey, I've been around the world playing hockey, and mm-hmm. I find that even though there's these linguistic and cultural barriers, you find that common ground when it comes to sport. You do share a certain language, so we did sort of meet on common ground, and they understood that I loved baseball enough to come to Italy to write about it and to help coach the team, and I understood that in a nation, in a soccer loving nation, the fact that they were true to baseball, you know, we can meet on that sort of common level. So there was mutual respect after a while.
Now, beyond that, you ended up leading the team in one important category, and that was raking.
True, Mike. You know, my neighborly Canadian skills came in handy there. That's right. You know, these guys didn't like to slide into home very often because they were afraid that their uniforms were just going to get too messed up, and their moms were in the crowd too. So they wanted, and, you know, style is very important to the Italian athlete, certainly the Italian ball player. So when we showed up to the diamond one day and found that, you know, the lawn had been manicured but hadn't been raked, it was left to the Canadian to show them how to get it done, get it done fast so the ball field would be playable. And I kind of took matters in my own hand and showed them. I guess I introduced raking to that team actually over that summer. So whether they've deployed those skills since, I'm not sure. But I didn't mind getting my feet wet.
Former Red Sox and Expos pitcher Bill Lee once said of baseball that it was mostly standing around spitting and laughing at stupid things. And baseball in Italy is that, I guess, but also sneaking vulgar Italian words into the writer's notebook and eating all the time and making sure there's plenty of espresso in the dugout. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. This is funny. I don't know if you've seen the film Spinal Tap, but there's the moment where Derek Smalls goes through the metal detector and he's got a cucumber wrapped in foil stuffed in his pants. There was a similar incident when we were flying to Sardinia. One of the players was going through the metal detector and it went off like crazy. It turned out he had had a panino, a big Italian sandwich wrapped in foil kind of hidden under his jacket that he got busted for. But these guys, they would bring their bats, their balls, their helmets and spikes in one bag for these away games. And then they would have another huge kit bag filled with pizza, focaccio, sandwiches that their mothers had made, grapes that were vital to them. They were important parts of these road trips. And sure enough, seventh inning stretch, well, usually, we know what that represents here. For them, it was the second wave of espresso, basically. And, hey, listen, I didn't mind. I mean, in terms of dugout cuisine, it sure beat, sunflower seeds and hot dogs. It was fine living to a point.
It sounds there. Like it was wonderful. During the season, you were confronted with a potential disaster. One of the players about whom you enjoyed writing particularly, Paolo, was on the brink of quitting because the manager wasn't playing him. How did you manage to change his mind?
Paolo and I had a bond. I mean, before I went to Nettuno, I had figured being an hour outside of Rome, there would be a handful of people at least who spoke English. But as it turned out, the Nettunese, none of them knew any English. I think they study a year in school, and that's pretty much it. So I was left foundering a lot of the time, or trying to scrabble together and use my kind of bad schoolroom Italian, which I'd studied before my trip. But Paolo spoke really well, so we had a bond, and he kind of took me under his wing and would explain to me certain problems on the team, or if a coach would have an argument with a player, he would translate for me. So we became really tight, and he kind of confided in me one day on the way to the ballpark that he had been a power hitter, but he'd quit baseball to go to oceanography school, actually, and was trying to work his way back into the lineup. And he said to me on the way to the ballpark, Dave, if I get a chance to get in at bat, I'll try to hit a home run for you. And it was like, that was great. I felt really great. And, we had developed this close bond. Finally, he got to the plate. It was his first at-bat in 6 years. Pietro finally played him. This was in Sardinia on this horribly dangerous, cracked field. I mean, Sardinia is very, very dry. And the ballpark was really overgrown. And I remember actually going out before the game started and sort of searching through some of this overgrowth. And I found, like, old barbed wire rolled up and old rakes and stuff and bricks that very, very dangerous where you're pulling it. So it was a treacherous place to play, but Paolo finally got up to the bat, and the team was really excited too because he was a veteran and they all really liked him, and Paolo kind of got along with everybody. And I had thought first at bat in 6 years, he's going to maybe look at a few, but sure enough, the pitcher straight down the heart of the plate and Paolo connected, and didn't it fly out of the yard? And wasn't that home run for me? It was one of those great, great moments that, I'll just remember for the rest of my life.
Obviously, you made some friends among the Peones, and I'm wondering if you've stayed in touch with any of the players and if you know what they're up to now.
Yeah, it's actually quite unfortunate. The first email, one of the first emails I got after I'd finished the book was one from Fabio telling me that Pietro had been let go, actually. So that was sort of sad. They're kind of, I don't think the team has actually stayed together, which is unfortunate, but we stay in contact every now and then, and I actually thought that the fact that I was documenting their lives and the lives of this town and, their team's season would have left a greater impression upon them. But I don't think they really have the sense of what a sports book is. For a while, I kind of overcompensated and really oversold. I said, one day this book will be in all the libraries in North America. But because they don't really people don't really write those kind of books in Italy. I mean, people don't even read books in Italy anyways. It didn't really register with them that... So I'm not really sure. I mean, to me, they still think of me as this scrub who kind of just wandered into their lives one summer and then left 6 months later. So I'm sure that, you know, that the fact that I'm talking to Bill Littlefield in NPR probably doesn't mean too much to them. It means a great deal to me, but, you know...
Well, one problem is, as you say, with one exception, they didn't speak English. So you could go back to Nettuno and put the book in their hands, and it still wouldn't make much of an impression. Maybe they'd recognize their names, but what else?
See, in a way, it was a journalist's dream because I could write whatever I wanted to about these guys, and I knew it wouldn't come back to bite me. So it was kind of a great freedom, actually.
Dave Fedini is the author of Baseballissimo, My Summer in the Italian Leagues, published by McClelland and Stewart Limited. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure, Bill.
Sotto il cielo di Roma, don't know what the country's coming to, but in Rome do as the Romans do. Will you, on an evening in Roma, sotto il cielo di Roma, on an evening in Roma.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com. And by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Major League Soccer's 10th season on the brink. But first, Charlie Pierce, ready for discussion of the week's news, joins me from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Something up in St. Louis this weekend?
Yeah, it's a basketball thing going on downtown. It's really quite nice for the tourists.
I knew that.
Hanging out at the casinos myself.
I'm sure that you're aware of the connection your alma mater, Marquette University, has to a Final Four team, Charlie, and perhaps it will provide you with some consolation to tell our listeners how Illinois coach Bruce Weber learned the game in Marquette's gym.
He is indeed a Yahe himself from the banks of the Menominee. He learned in the old gym, which has the spiral staircases and the running track cutting off the corners.
Excellent.
And not only that, but current Marquette coach Tom Crean learned the biz under Tom Izzo at Michigan State, who's also in the Final Four. It all essentially comes back to Wisconsin Avenue.
Is it fair to say that the sentimental choice is Roy Williams? Because although UNC has won lots and lots and lots of basketball tournaments, Coach Roy Williams has never led a team to a national championship.
I may weep. Seriously, I may weep for poor Roy Williams. Poor Roy Williams has had the best team in the country about 4 times in his career, and he hasn't led it to the national championship. I do not sympathize with him. If there's a sentimental choice to me, it's Illinois, who is now on the brink of being 37-1, and there still aren't 15 people in America who can figure out why. They're a really good team. They're a really likable team. And if I had to put my sentiment anywhere among these, you know, 4 multinationals that are competing here, it would be with them.
One notable absence in St. Louis is Chief Illiniwek, the University of Illinois' controversial mascot. Any evidence that he's missed?
Oh, but there's great grumbling among the assembled Illini that the chief will not be here. I suspect the chief may be here in Mufti.
Wait, a Marlowe reference, a Shakespeare reference. I'm very impressed. The women of hoops will be dancing just a few clicks northeast of where you are, Charlie. Would you care to pick a winner from the Fab Foursome that includes Michigan State, Tennessee, Baylor, and LSU?
Wait a minute. Baylor, LSU, Michigan State?
Yes.
Where's Connecticut?
Oh, are they?
I thought there were only 3 women's teams in the country.
You see, things are changing. Connecticut fell by the wayside early, and Michigan State is crashing the Final Four for the first time.
Yes, and Michigan State obviously Michigan State has a chance to do what Connecticut did, which is to win both titles in the same year. If I had to pick one just for fun, I mean, wouldn't it be a hoot, pardon the expression, to see Baylor win the national championship?
They've never been there before either. Yeah, it'd be great.
I mean, bring the trophy back to Waco and then, like, you know, stay there.
The baseball season begins tomorrow night with the traditional opening night game between the Yankees and the Red Sox. When did opening night replace opening day as a
another
baseball tradition?
Of another show. Yes, baseball season begins with the traditional opening night game between the Yankees and the Red Sox, and the tradition in my household of my driving 10-penny nails into my eyes. But now this is of course for television, which is something we should just put on a default setting every time we talk about anything. But we do have an interesting matchup, of course, in the quadrogenarian pitchers of Randy Johnson for the Yankees and David Wells for the Red Sox.
The Government Reform Committee that teed off on and was teed off by a host of Major League Baseball's prime movers past and present is at it again, Charlie. Representative Henry Waxman is threatening to turn his all-seeing eye on the NFL, the NBA, the NCAA, U.S. track and field, Major League Soccer, and even the National Hockey League. Who did he leave out?
Wait a minute. First of all, how's he going to find the National Hockey League?
Well, it's going to be a far-reaching committee, you know, into the wilds of Europe.
No one's doing steroids. Everyone's at home eating Cheetos. If Major League Soccer is desperate for national attention and to be reckoned among the major sports, here's its chance. You can testify right along with the NBA. We knew that this was going to roll out of control, and it pretty much has. I am going to be very interested, though, having watched the baseball hearings, to hear every congressman prior to his questioning preface it by how he and his dad used to go to MLS games when he was a boy.
This week, a South Carolina doctor who had allegedly given steroids to three players on the 2003 Carolina Panthers said that he's always careful about prescribing the drug. So I guess that's okay, right?
I just have this wonderful vision of a strip mall in South Carolina with Dr. Buck steroids and live bait in neon in front. Hey, Billy, give me some of that testosterone. It's on the back shelf next to the Nightcrawlers.
Biographical material about Major League Baseball's Dr. Elliot J. Pellman, who testified before Congress about steroid use in that game, turns out to be misleading at best. He got his medical training in Mexico rather than New York. Representative Henry Waxman is upset, but baseball's vice president, Robert Manfred, said this week, quote, "I don't see why it should impact Dr. Pellman's credibility." Do you?
Well, it's going to. I'll tell you what, Rob. The next time you go see a doctor to try to parcel out what this really, really serious symptom of yours might be, let's let him lie about his credentials. I didn't go to Harvard. I went to Bob's Med School. Let's see
which
how
is
Rob
next
Manfred
to the bait shop
up.
Where the steroids it's are on the
next
shelf.
Next to Dr. Buck's steroids and live bait, exactly.
New York City's Metropolitan Transportation Authority approved the New York Jets' $720 million bid, and plans for a $1.9 billion stadium for Gotham are underway. Any truth to the rumor that the stadium will be named the Juan Antonio Samaranch Dome or perhaps the Jacques?
Pardon me, Mr. Boone, have you met Mr. Doggle? Mr. Doggle, Mr. Boone, let's get together and build us a ballpark. Boy, is this a bad idea on so many levels. The Olympics in New York is a bad idea on so many levels, let alone this incredible white elephant that Mayor Bloomberg has hitched his re-election star to. This is just awful.
In Manchester, New Hampshire, 103 Little League ballplayers were recruited to flush all the toilets in the new home of the Manchester Fisher Cats minor league baseball team. Allegedly, this was to, quote, clear any impurities out of the system. The stadium is brand new. What impurities do you suppose they're worried about?
This sounds like a riff from Dr. Strangelove, doesn't it, about our precious bodily fluids? But, Bill, as you know, this is not unprecedented. Because when your New England Patriots opened their previous stadium, which was then called Schaefer Stadium in Foxborough, there was some thought that perhaps the water pressure of an entire crowd would overwhelm the plumbing. So all the employees of the New England Patriots had to go out into the various facilities and do an ensemble flush to see if it worked. So this is not unprecedented in the wide world of sports.
Finally, Charlie, Australian racing officials were reviewing safety procedures Thursday after five jockeys were hurt when a flock of seagulls suddenly rose up off the track and flew into their horses during a recent race. And all I can say is fix!
Well, not just that, but it's the first time in 20 years I've heard a flock of seagulls. What were they doing playing a concert in the middle of the racetrack in the first place?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Andy joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Major League Soccer begins its 10th season today with 6 games, including a nationally televised match between defending champion DC United and one of the league's 2 new teams, Chivas USA, from the Home Depot Center, the soccer-specific stadium that's also home to the Los Angeles Galaxy. The beginning of Season 10 seems an appropriate time to gauge the progress of MLS. Joining me now for that purpose is Scott Warfield, a staff writer for Sports Business Journal. Scott, welcome to Only a Game.
Appreciate the time, Bill.
MLS has added 2 teams this season. Is expansion at this point a sign that the league's management is confident?
Most definitely. I mean, we're adding, the league, I should say, is adding 2 teams, one in Salt Lake and a second team in L.A. And more importantly, the owners, investors that are coming on is the best sign. We've got Jorge Vergara, a billionaire, that has a club, Chivas Guadalajara, that will be opening another team, an American squad, in L.A., and in addition to that, we also have Dave Checkitz, an entrepreneur who has a deep background in the sports industry. And so not only in addition to expansion, but it's who exactly we're bringing in. That's a sign of the progress the league has made.
The Anschutz Entertainment Group still owns 5 of the 12 teams in the league. Haven't those running MLS hoped that by 10 years in, MLS wouldn't be so dependent on one company or really on one man?
Well, yeah, Bill, that actually was the way they set it up 10 years ago, was to have a few key guys slowly sell it off. And actually, Tim Leiwicki, I spoke with him a few weeks ago, president of Anschutz Entertainment Group, and he led me to believe that by the end of the year, they will only own 3 teams. It looks like they'll be trying to get out of 2 of those teams and bringing in, like I said, some more of these investor operators that have the deep pockets, that have the interest in the local communities.
Several teams, the Galaxy, Chivas USA, the Columbus Crew, are playing in soccer-specific stadia, and FC Dallas will soon be doing that. But 8 other teams are still playing on football or baseball fields, all of them ill-suited to soccer to some degree. When will we see the next soccer-specific venues, and how much will they change the league's prospects?
Well, no doubt, anywhere from the front office to the individual teams, soccer-specific stadiums is what everyone's looking at for the future. Like you said, we're going to have Dallas opening one up this year. Chicago has plans to build a soccer-specific stadium. They actually have started construction. There's plans in place in Denver, the New York, New Jersey area, Salt Lake, and even in D.C. I would venture to say within the next 3, 4, 5 years, a majority of the teams will be playing in these soccer-specific stadiums, which allows a lot of these teams to move a lot closer to profitability.
Optimists say soccer's TV ratings were up from last year, but pessimists say the increase was inconsequential. They were so low before that even a small increase doesn't mean anything, and soccer hasn't captured the attention of those who watch sports on TV. Who's right on this one?
Both. No one's going to lie about it. They aren't getting the ratings they want. I mean, a 0.2 last year for their 25 ESPN2 broadcast, about on the level of repeats of the 2004 World Series of Poker. But that is a double-digit increase in ratings from year to year. And they're making strides on that front as far as production, adding cameras, making the sport a more enjoyable thing to watch on TV.
Well, when you talk about making it more enjoyable to watch, Randy Burstein, who was the league's chief marketing officer for the first 6 years of MLS, has said that the league should be, quote, making the game more exciting in the way that it's communicated to the public. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think this year you're going to see a number of things, from use of Skycam. You've seen that in NFL coverage. They're going to try that. They're going to have added cameras. You know, instead of having 6 cameras, they're going to have 11. They're going to have more replay machines so that after a shot into the upper 90, they can switch from the corner kick angle to midfield and present a much more English Premier League-like broadcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an obvious difference between watching an English Premier League game and watching an MLS game, and I think slowly, as the ratings increase and more money can be put towards the production, you're going to see a much better presented product on television.
What has to happen in terms of attendance, TV audience, corporate support, or whatever other measure might be appropriate for people to stop asking if pro soccer is going to make it in the U.S.?
Well, I don't think it's one of those things. I think it's a combination of everything. Obviously, 2006 is going to be a very important year as far as the World Cup and the U.S.'s performance on the national stage. In 2002, when the Americans were in Korea for the World Cup, the excitement around the sport was tenfold what it is on a normal day. So another solid performance in the World Cup, continuing to build these soccer-specific stadiums, increase ratings because of the production enhancements, all those things, a combination of everything it's going to take to really make this more than just a niche sport. They know the obstacles they have. They're addressing them, and they're headed in the right direction.
Scott Warfield is a staff writer for the Sports Business Journal. Scott, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, I appreciate your time.
Warm days are just a promise. Still, the games will soon arrive on fields across the country where the grass has come alive. And on legs limbered up again, in jerseys crisp and clean, the lads will once more trot onto the field. We haven't seen their like since last the season ended, leaving us with naught but football and then basketball, two games in which I've sought refreshment and rejuvenation, but without a thing that can begin to cheer the spirit like the game of spring and summer. It's a game we cherish for its April start. It melts the cramps of winter and delights the sluggish heart made heavy by the long gray days when we can only dream of contests in the summer's heat, a game that may not seem these days as big a draw as football or as fast a show as hoops the way it's played in college, let alone the pros, but still a game without which our sports calendar would lack the long flight of the ball against the blue sky. That's a fact. And lack as well the summer's rhythm built into the game of time when nothing seems to happen, till as crowds exclaim, the wonder of a brilliant move that turns the game around, and players on the field are buried in the roar of sound that dazzling moment can provoke, as fans leap to their feet and cheer as they have not cheered since the summer passed, the sweet brave moment wherein old men who for years have calmly sat and watched 500 games turn and exclaim, "Did you see that?" And yes, they have, because the game is simple as it's been. But no, they haven't, for within its frame each play can mean a beautiful reminder of the grace, what's more to say, the timing and the will, but more the joy of that one play. So now you've heard my tale, and now I'm sure you'll understand why I'm so glad that spring's come. Soccer's back upon the land.
I was coaching my first team in the fall of 98. My grandson was the forward, and the game was going great. When the ref, he made a call that raised the hackles on my hide. I think he was an Englishman. He said,
"Your boy's offside.
Offside! Offside! If you're guilty, there's no place that you can hide. Offside! Offside! You'll be punished if you take a pass while you're standing offside."
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mary Edwards at KWMU in St. Louis and from Ron Godey at CBC Manitoba. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Baseballissima, browse Only a Game's show archive, or perhaps sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Only a Game's own Charlie Pierce.
I ran so far away.
Next up in Charlie's New Wave Review, 6 months in a Leaky Boat by Split Enz, Robert De Niro's Waiting by Bananarama, and the entire song catalog by Gary Newman and Tubeway Army.
Mildred, what is he talking about?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Imagine all the points that would be scored without this rule. It would reach the double digits. Then our queen would look a fool. It would crush the British Empire, or at least what still remains. Remember 1776? You Yanks are such a pain. We've got to keep a lid on the excitement in this sport. It disturbs my indigestion, and it irritates my wart. To lose our sacred laws is an affront we can't abide. There'll always be a penalty for loitering offside.
Offside! Offside! If you're guilty, there's no place that you can hide. Offside, offside. You'll be punished if you take a pass while you're standing offside.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.